that you have transcended all suffering, and this is the goal of the practice. This is how he was initially taught. But what was great about the Buddha was he didn't just take things on face value. He deeply investigated them. And what he noticed was that, yes, indeed, when he was able to be in these states of great withdrawal, that all suffering was suspended. But when he wasn't in those states, he was still subject to bad habits. He was still subject to suffering. He concluded that this alone wouldn't do it. Just being able to be withdrawn and peaceful was not the final solution that he was seeking. And as a meditation teacher, I can tell you it's quite true. One of the most common cul-de-sacs, or blind alleys, that people get involved in when they meditate is that they'll be able to get to a state that's sort of peaceful, and when they sit down and meditate, they go into that peaceful state. When they come out and go about their day-to-day life, they feel very relaxed. It gives them an edge on things. But year after year, there isn't dramatic transformation. There aren't earth-shaking changes in that person's behavior and perception. It's an example of what I call getting caught in a good place. And a lot of people have this phenomenon in their meditation. So one has to go beyond states of just being calm and peaceful, even really deep states of just being calm and peaceful. And the Buddha to be, Prince Siddhartha, recognized this. So he didn't just accept what he was given by these teachers. Because they said, now you can do it. Okay, you can sit in these absorbed states. You've mastered it quicker than anybody else ever did. Share our community here. You can teach with us, and you've got it made. But he had a critical spirit, very much like a scientist. He knew he didn't have it made, that this alone wasn't enough. The technology of states of high concentration, of course, had existed in India prior to the Buddha's time. Another tradition that had existed in India was the practice of asceticism. Asceticism means denying oneself or perhaps actually taking on discomfort in the name of a spiritual path. The famous ascetical practices of the West have left their mark on our English language. We talk about self-flagellation, meaning nowadays to, you know, feel guilty or feel that you're worthless. We talk about wearing a hair shirt, means essentially the same thing. These were practices that were done. A hair shirt is a horsehair undergarment that is extremely scratchy and uncomfortable. And people in the Christian tradition would sometimes wear this all the time, so it'd always be a little uncomfortable. Now, self-flagellation means exactly that. You take a kind of whip that is called a disciplina, actually. And most people can't imagine how you flagellate yourself. Well, the way you do it is over your shoulder, onto your back. So it is quite possible to flagellate yourself. But there are other ascetical practices followed in the West, fasting, vigils, which means a sleep deprivation type situation. In fact, the last remnant of asceticism within the Christian tradition was only recently abandoned, and the reason it was abandoned is it had become a meaningless remnant, and that was the custom of not eating meat on Friday, because the European peoples are such carnivores. Giving up meat was looked upon as a big ascetical sacrifice. And some orders in Christianity never ate meat. They were vegetarian. But not so much from the viewpoint of health, and not so much from the viewpoint of compassion, but more from the viewpoint that that was looked upon as a form of sacrifice, self-torture, if you will. And that left a symbolic remnant in Catholicism of fish on Friday, you give up meat. a pale reflection of the medieval ascetical tradition. In India, there were also ascetical practices, and some of them were similar: sleep deprivation, fasting, and some of them were unique to India. For example, there was a practice called the Five Fires. You light a fire to the north, south, east, west, bonfire. You sit in between those four on a cloudless summer day with the sun beating down on your head as the fifth fire. The word for asceticism in Sanskrit is tapas, T-A-P-A-S. It's actually related to the English word tepid, and it means to heat up, literally. I guess that was one of the major practices. The idea that somebody would voluntarily expose themselves to discomfort or deprivation for a spiritual goal is confusing and off-putting to most modern people. They can't understand why anybody would do this, and they're offended by the idea of doing it. But ascetical practice is found all over the world. It's ubiquitous. And it was a major feature of India. However, the paradigm or concept of why do asceticism differs from place to place. In ancient India, there were two beliefs about asceticism. One is that if you could just make yourself uncomfortable enough long enough, you could burn out your karma. You could burn out the limiting forces within you and become free. The second was that you could attain special psychic powers and enter the realm of the gods and actually unseat Indra, the king of the gods, Zeus, and take over Mount Sumeru, which would be the equivalent of Mount Olympus. If you could put yourself through enough discomfort long enough, you could shake the throne of the king of the gods. In other words, it would thrust you into the spirit world and give you all sorts of powers. These were two concepts about asceticism. Buddha was not Buddha yet, but as Prince Siddhartha Gautama, after seeing that the mere concentration alone didn't seem to clean him out enough, joined a community of ascetics. Actually, they were proto-Jains. It's a whole other tradition in India called Jainism or Jainism. And he was in their company for 6 years, and he outdid everybody in self-torture. Very strong-willed person. All of that concentration practice certainly helped, too. He would do extreme fasting, starting with eating 16 beans, and then the next day eating 15 beans, and the next day eating 14, until he got down to one bean, and then eating two beans, three beans, and ending up at the end of the month again with 16 beans. This was one among the things that he exposed himself to. Also, things like attempting to hold the breath for very long periods of time until one convulses. All sorts of pretty extreme stuff is rather vividly described. And he did it for 6 years in order to become free from karma, that is to say, the limiting influences of the past, to purify the deep consciousness and to become free. And he was clear enough, wise enough, to realize that after 6 years it hadn't worked as he was doing it, and to abandon it, much to the chagrin of the community that he was associated with. He abandoned the extreme practices. He ate, he bathed himself, made himself relatively comfortable, and continued his practice in a more middle or balanced mode, not indulging in the senses, but also not indulging in extremes of self-deprivation and self-torture. It is sometimes said that the Buddha rejected asceticism. In fact, almost any book that you read on Buddhist history will probably have some paragraph to that effect. He rejected asceticism. But I would rather say that he refined asceticism, because the practice that he developed, which was called the middle way, would seem to most North Americans to actually be rather ascetical, because it involves having to sit still for long periods of time, having to put up with aches and pains of different sorts, having to deal with a certain amount of sensory deprivation. I would still consider Buddhist practice a form of asceticism, but refined. Refined both in terms of what is actually done, things that are so intense as to make you weak or to hurt you are not done in the Buddhist tradition, and also refined in terms of the concept of what the asceticism is all about, how it works, how the purification actually takes place, and why we should do it. Remember, in ancient India, the idea of why to do it is you could get incredible powers. It would thrust you into what, in a previous talk, I described as that intermediate realm of power. That was one reason it was done. Another concept behind it was that just by dint of intensity of the voluntary discomfort, you would be freeing yourself, breaking up karma. The Buddha formulated a different model for asceticism. He refined it. Basically, he took the two things that he had learned, the practice of high concentration and asceticism, and reorganized it into a kind of practice that had not existed previously, perhaps on this planet, the practice that we now call mindfulness. The idea being that one develops a certain degree of concentration and then uses that concentration like a microscope to very carefully observe what is going on. Unlike the practice that says concentration is an end to itself and the goal is to just get as deep and withdrawn as you can, here the idea is concentration is a tool that can transform your understandings, a tool with which you can learn, and as the result of that, come to understandings that free you from suffering and do a lot of other things that are desirable. Likewise, the idea behind the Buddha's version of asceticism is it is not the intensity of discomfort you put yourself through, but rather the degree of equanimity that you bring to that discomfort that does the job. So it's not a matter of just using the force of gross intensity to try to break up karma. You can take any experience, even a mild discomfort or a pleasure or a neutral experience, and if you bring mindfulness and equanimity to it, you're breaking up karma. That is to say, you're freeing yourself from limiting influences from the past. So in that sense, it is a practical and conceptual refinement of asceticism. If suffering equals pain multiplied by resistance, then spiritual purification equals pain multiplied by equanimity, but it also equals pleasure multiplied by equanimity. The kinds of practices that are now done in Buddhism, which involve perhaps sitting through some aches and pains in your legs or through some sleepiness, are dealing with rather mild discomforts. It's nothing like virtually starving yourself to death or torturing yourself with heat or cold. But those small discomforts are greeted with an enormous amount of equanimity, number one, and number two, mindfulness, so that there's a clear learning process that goes on. You can really see suffering equals pain multiplied by resistance because you're observing. You're not just beating yourself over the head with deprivation and discomfort. So he used the concentration states a little bit differently, and he refined the asceticism and gave us this unique practice that nowadays is called vipassana meditation or mindfulness meditation or insight meditation. It's a very important discovery because it means that even in day-to-day life, the average person, if they're willing to have a strong intention to infuse equanimity into just the ordinary minor irritations that we encounter in day-to-day life. Sometimes we're tired. Sometimes, you know, we're late to an appointment and we feel tension. If we can bring an extraordinary degree of mindfulness and equanimity to these ordinary discomforts, we'll get the same kind of purification that people had to go through incredible physical ordeals to achieve in previous times. So this is that purification equals pain multiplied by equanimity is a very important paradigm, because you can take little pains, and if you have real big equanimity, you get real big purification because of the multiplicative nature of the linear function. And this is the basis for what in Buddhism is called the middle way. This approach predominated in early Buddhism, the mindfulness practice. And Vipassana is the name that is usually given to this approach to meditating. Now, of course, as I intimated, the idea of a spiritual path based primarily on careful detached observation is in no way unique to the early Buddhist tradition. Similar approaches exist elsewhere. In some ways, Krishnamurti's idea of choiceless awareness is that. In some ways, Gurdjieff's idea of being awake in day-to-day life is very related to that. And within Christianity, in the Eastern Orthodox school of Christianity, that is to say Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, etc., they have practices that are based on this. There's a word in Greek, nepsis. It means sober observation. With a lot of matter-of-factness, you observe what is. And through this sober observation, you are able to achieve catharsis, radical cleansing. And that culminates in theosis, which means from theos, the Greek for God, it means becoming godlike in this very life. And that was a stated goal, is a stated goal in the Orthodox Catholic concept of what Christianity is about. They believe in the possibility of radical purification, not just salvation by faith, grace, and good works, but something a little more akin to what the Buddhists have in mind. And that, of course, is the earliest of the Christian traditions, and I think in some ways best represents Christianity, although in America, because of the influence of Protestantism and Roman Catholicism, that earlier Eastern form of Christianity that centers in Palestine and Egypt, which is, after all, the heartland of Christianity, that is less known. But from a Buddhist perspective, it's absolutely amazing how similar, in some ways, their methods are to the Vipassana method of infusing mindfulness and equanimity in order to achieve insight and purification. And in fact, in the Eastern Orthodox tradition, they would even meditate on the body sensations associated with the emotions as they would come up. And they would locate the core of these body sensations in the heart and in the viscera. And they would sit in postures that produced stability, just like people that do Buddhist meditation do, so that there could be a settling for this careful observation. And they would even turn their head down so that they would direct their attention into the viscera and into the heart and the whole chest cavity where the feelings would arise. And then they'd apply sober observation to these feelings as they came up. They knew, as the Buddhists knew, that feeling is in the body. The mindfulness approach certainly exists outside of Vipassana meditation. However, it is probably most systematically developed in that tradition. And most of what I've been presenting to you in this series is based on that vipassana approach. The basic idea in vipassana is, as the ancient Romans said, dividere et impera. It means divide and conquer. If you can break an experience down into its components, the components are manageable, you can observe them with equanimity, you can see through the experience, and you will find that you are less gripped and limited by it. Early Buddhism put a tremendous emphasis on this not being gripped and limited by conditions. In other words, becoming free from suffering. But there are more facets on the jewel of enlightenment than the one side called becoming free from suffering. Some of those other facets needed to be developed and expressed. Mahayana Buddhism, the great vehicle, addressed some of those issues. Just to clarify terminology, because people easily become confused, vipassana is a kind of meditation, a style of meditation, that is associated historically with a school of Buddhism called Theravada, Theravada. And Theravada is the sole surviving school of Hinayana. There were actually, depending on how you want to count it, 16 or 18 sort of lineages within early Buddhism. The differences were not terribly significant. They were all generically small vehicle. One of those lineages was called the teachings of the elders. Thera is elder, Vada is a teaching, Theravada, and it's the only one that has survived. The representative practice of Theravada Buddhism at this time is vipassana meditation. Theravada Buddhism is the sole surviving school of Hinayana Buddhism. Hinayana Buddhism is what dominated Indian Buddhism for the first 500 years or so, and which is now preserved primarily in the Southeast Asian countries of Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka. Of course, from there it has spread back into India in our century, and it has spread to the West and all over. Vipassana is found everywhere now in the world. One of the issues that was not fully dealt with in early Buddhism was the relationship between one's individual liberation and one's responsibility to one's fellow beings. Early Buddhism put a very great emphasis on the individual becoming free and getting out of the cycle of reincarnation, out of the cycle of karma. Later on, when Mahayana developed, they said that helping other people, being of service, is as important as the individual becoming free, absolutely equal in importance. And the idea was not to get out of the cycle of reincarnation. The idea was to break the drivenness in that cycle and then voluntarily stay inside the cycle of reincarnation so that you could, for eternity, serve, of course, as a liberated being, but serve, not tune in and drop out. Okay? The Mahayana people accused the small vehicle of wanting to tune in to cosmic consciousness and sort of drop out of the whole mundane cycle. And so they said, this is a limited perspective. So they called it Hinayana, or a narrow vehicle, a small vehicle. Mahayana, the logical, is a bigger perspective. When Buddhism evolved into Mahayana, it started to evolve into a, quote, religion. Early Buddhism lacked a lot of the features that we would associate with a, quote, religion. That's why in the 19th century, when Europeans discovered early Buddhism, they liked it so much, because it seems to have had all of the good features of a deep spiritual path and lack all of the bad features of organized religion. Well, like it or not, along with the Mahayana concept of the Bodhisattva, who practices compassionate action for others on an equal footing with wisdom, Along with that came a whole lot of mythology, a whole lot of hierarchy, a whole lot of things that we tend to associate with religion. About 2,000 years ago, Mahayana entered China and began a long process of Sinification, being made into something Chinese. As I mentioned, that culminated in the Chan practice, the Zen practice. However, Zen represents the second prevalent Buddhist practice. Once again, it's now found everywhere in the world. When one studies Zen, one may study Vietnamese Zen, Japanese Zen, Korean Zen, or Chinese Zen. It's more complicated than even that, though. Just within Japan, there are two schools of Zen, and they are philosophically completely different, totally different, even though they're both called Zen. One of the major paradoxes on the spiritual path is the paradox of efforting versus allowing. And how to work that paradox to understand the relationship between bearing down and easing up is a major conundrum for the meditator. A related issue is the issue of enlightenment is something we attain versus the view that enlightenment is where we're already at, and we can't attain it because it's what is. So if you follow a path of effort, you're trying to get to some place that has both uses and it also creates problems. If you follow the path of no effort, but abide in that enlightenment already is, it's not something to be attained, that viewpoint has uses, and it also has problems. Both viewpoints are useful, and both viewpoints create problems. Is the spiritual path a path of self-effort, or is the spiritual path a path of opening to grace? Within the Buddhist context, they speak in Japanese of hongaku and shikaku. Hon means original, shi means for the first time. Kaku means enlightened. So hongaku means you're already enlightened, shikaku means you get enlightened for the first time. You weren't already enlightened. The Rinzai school of Japanese Zen is based on the concept of shikaku. You're not enlightened now, and you have to pass a whole bunch of koans, 1,750 of them, and after you've passed each one, you will be enlightened. The Soto Zen school is based on the concept of hongaku. You're already enlightened, and in order to exemplify that, to symbolize that fact, you do a lot of sitting in the lotus posture. And that practice is called shikantaza in Japanese, meaning just sitting. The sitting meditation, therefore, can have different meanings within different traditions. I like to think that sitting has three very distinct functions. According to the Soto Zen way of thinking, sitting exemplifies the fact that we're already enlightened. We take the posture of the Buddha, and we sit to express our innate enlightenment. What does that mean in practical terms? Well, it means you try to sit frequently and long, and when you sit, you try to remain alert and in contact with what is, and not grasp onto any particular thing. It's called just sitting because it's mindfulness and equanimity applied to the sitting posture, in essence. You sit down, you're aware of sitting, and you continue to be aware of sitting and try not to fixate on any particular thing as it comes up. You're not cultivating a technique per se, although I think you can see that the principles of mindfulness and equanimity are implicit in this practice. But there's no goal that you're going to get more concentrated or get deeper insight into impermanence or have samadhi experience or this or that. However, because you do take as good a posture as you can, and you sit long and frequently, that posture is going to start to have an impact on you. So you might say that it's a kind of enlightenment through posture. So they call it just sitting. It gets rid of the problems of goal orientation and separating enlightenment from where you are right then and there. There's no specific technique, no procedure. In some ways, it's the opposite of vipassana, where we always give people technique and something to do. But in another sense, I think you can see that it's very similar to vipassana. It's sort of like vipassana without the techniques. The technique is the posture and the frequency and duration of the sit. But they do say, if you really pin them to the wall and say, you know, what should I be doing while I'm sitting there, you'll usually get an answer like, try to be very alert. The word in Japanese, kakusoku, it means like be alert and in contact. Or they'll say something like, don't hold on to any particular thing as it comes up. Or they'll say something like, be aware of everything as you're sitting there. On one hand, you can sit just to sit. That's Soto Zen. Then there's sitting as a situation that tends to produce settledness and simplicity. Sitting is a situation in which it's easier to get high states of concentration and easier to do delicate observations. That's using the sitting posture as an expedient to develop concentration and to carry on investigation. It's easier at the beginning to develop concentration and carry on investigation in a stable, comfortable, upright posture. So that's sitting as an expedient, a tool for concentration and insight. That's a second meaning for sitting, quite different from the sitting to sit. You're sitting to help you achieve some goals as far as concentration and observation goes. There's a third application of sitting. You may have a spiritual path that doesn't involve sitting. It involves something else, maybe Tai Chi, some sort of movement meditation, maybe an attempt to meditate in daily life constantly. There are even some Vipassana teachers, it's rare, but there are Vipassana teachers occasionally that won't let their students sit. They insist that the entire meditative practice be done in action. There's even occasionally Zen teachers that teach that way. Temples where there's no sitting practice, but it's very, very intense, and you're expected to get enlightenment and do everything while you're doing ordinary things. But that's exceptional because of that second use of sitting that I mentioned, that sitting is such a useful situation to develop concentration and insight. Most Buddhist teachers make use of it. But even within Buddhism, there are some paths that are meant to develop classic enlightenment without using the expedient of sitting still in a special posture. So you may be on a path that does not involve sitting. That's fine. Theoretically, it's certainly possible to have such a path. However, I would suggest that sitting is relevant even to a path like that. At least occasionally, you want to sit still for a long period of time. And the reason is that the sitting is a barometer for where you're at. All other activities in some way are distracting. Anything else you do, even something as slow as Tai Chi, there's a lot going on there. And you might not really see what's going on, specifically where you're at. In other words, if you follow a path that does not involve sitting still on a regular basis, you run the danger that you might be fooling yourself. You might think that your transcending of conditions is a lot more than it actually is. Sitting still and not moving is a special activity. It is the zero activity. It is the activity of no activity. And against that milieu, you can really see to what extent you have transcended conditions. So it becomes a sort of barometer or gold standard that you can use to measure the degree to which your practice is allowing you to really become a free person. Because if you think that your practice is bringing you freedom, which is to say that it is showing you a happiness independent of conditions, then you can most clearly see that in the situation where all conditions have been taken away and you're just sitting absolutely still with nothing going on. And then how do you relate to that nothing? If you're really, really becoming free, it's going to be heaven. But if after a half an hour or 2 hours or 4 or 5 hours of just sitting still, you find yourself in hell, you can't do it. You find a reason to rationalize the fact that you need to get up. Well, then obviously you haven't transcended conditions yet. Nothing wrong with that. You've gotten a reflection. You've gotten some feedback. A real objective barometer of how free you are. And so, okay, you go back to your practice, and maybe 6 months later, maybe a couple years later, try it again. See if you can sit there 5 hours, 6 hours, without having to move, without having to change conditions. And once again, you'll get a real clear picture to what extent are you free from the thoughts and feelings that come up as you sit there, and to what extent you're not free. You are identified with the thoughts and feelings. A person doesn't have to sit. I would never say that a person has to do a sitting practice to become liberated. But I would strongly suggest that sitting still and doing absolutely nothing is the quick and dirty, easy test to see to what extent is the practice that you do taking you to unconditional freedom. In Soto Zen, you sit to sit, but in Rinzai Zen, you sit to develop high states of concentration, to purify consciousness by putting up with all sorts of discomforts and pains, and to solve your koan. A koan is a problem that you can't solve with the rational mind. It is a question that is asked you that in fact boggles the rational mind and produces immense disorientation and confusion. What it means to solve the koan means to have complete equanimity, complete acceptance of that confusion, and to let it fill your entire being all your waking hours, and not to need to do anything about that fact. If you're willing to do that long enough, then you gradually work through the habit of needing to have answers. In other words, the koan is sort of a forced abstinence from the addiction of the mind to meaning. Okay, our minds are addicted to meaning. Have you noticed? They have to have meaning moment by moment. They have to have clarity. It's a kind of addiction. A teacher throwing a koan into your conceptual mind jams the mechanism and makes it hard to have meaning. You're just confused all the time. You're in chaos all the time, conceptually. And at first you flail around a little bit trying to figure out an answer with thought. But if you really understand how this whole thing works, you give up on that. And you just abide progressively more and more comfortable with your entire being being in confusion. Until finally, your mind starts to function undriven by the fear of confusion. It just happens. The mind just happens. The way rain just happens. And the answer just occurs the same way rain just falls. And so one has accessed another mode of understanding, not the mode that is driven by the need to have answers, but a more effortless mode of answers welling up. It's a way of cultivating the wisdom faculty. It's in stark contrast to how wisdom is cultivated in the Vipassana tradition. In the Vipassana tradition, wisdom is cultivated by carefully observing over and over and over again, and by formulating a clearer and clearer and clearer concept of how consciousness works. In Rinzai Zen, at least initially, the insights arise by the conceptual mind being jammed intensely enough and long enough that one goes into equanimity with it. And therefore, a new mode of functioning of consciousness arises. And that new mode of functioning can understand in a new way. Are we talking about two different kinds of wisdom? Is the wisdom that comes by careful observation different from the wisdom that comes through this intuitive upwelling, as in Rinzai Zen? Are they different wisdoms? Absolutely not. They are exactly the same enlightened wisdom, even though the methodology is completely different. One of the facets of enlightenment that was not dealt with very much in early Buddhism is the aspect called union or oneness. But that aspect is very much spoken of in the Taoist tradition. So not surprisingly, in Zen, which has these Taoist influences in it, the facet of enlightenment called oneness is important. So on one hand, in Rinzai Zen, they give you these koans that develop the intuitive faculty. But they also are related to learning how to have the experience of merging of inside and outside. For example, my teacher makes up his own koans. He doesn't just use the ones that are in old Chinese books. He'll ask people, how do you realize God when you see this flower? Well, of course, what he's asking you to do is have an experience of becoming the flower. I talked in great detail in the previous discussions about how this integration or oneness takes place, and its relationship to concentration power, and even to impermanence. So Rinzai Zen puts a lot of emphasis on that oneness. Actually, Soto Zen does too, but not as a kind of goal over there. So if I had to characterize Zen or Chan in an oversimplified way, I would say that it represents an East Asian modification of Indian Mahayana Buddhism, and that it has brought in elements of a concept of oneness of inside and outside that were not emphasized strongly in early Buddhism. The Vajrayana school, the third school of Buddhism, is known by a number of synonyms. It's sometimes called Mantrayana because it makes use of mantras. And in fact, Shingon, the Shingon school, which I mentioned, school that I was ordained in, actually literally means mantra. It's the mantra school. Sometimes Vajrayana Buddhism is called esoteric Buddhism because it was kept secret. You had to be initiated into the rituals and ceremonies. Of course, the Buddha told his disciples that he kept nothing secret. He revealed everything. He said, I do not have the Acharya Mushti. I do not have the fist of the teacher that withholds anything that I know. Everything I know, I have told you, and I've told everybody. But by the time you get into Vajrayana, it's very secretive. So it's called esoteric, or secret Buddhism. And the earlier schools of Buddhism were then named exoteric, or revealed to the masses. And Vajrayana, finally, is also sometimes called tantric Buddhism, T-A-N-T-R-I-C, a word totally misunderstood by the general populace. If you ask the average person what that word means, if they have heard it at all, they probably will tell you it has something to do with sexuality or sexo-spiritual practices, or using the experience of making love as a vehicle for spiritual practice. That is not what the word tantra means historically. There's not one whiff of sexual in the etymology of that word. The early Buddhist scriptures were called sutra. It's actually related to the English word suture, means thread or something sewn together. In the ancient world, the idea of an organized discourse was very linked in people's minds to the idea of the organized threads would make a fabric. We actually have that same concept in our English language, although we don't recognize it. We talk about textbook, usually not realizing that, of course, the text there is related to textile, something that's been woven. So they had the idea of something sewn together, it's woven together, and the other thing is they actually did sew the books physically together, the pages, the leaves of the books. So sutra was what the early Buddhist scriptures were called. By the time Buddhism developed into Vajrayana, the scriptures were no longer named sutra. Another word for teaching or text was used, and that word was tantra. So in early Buddhism, you have scriptures like the Lotus Sutra, the Saddharma Pundarika Sutra, or the Vajracchedika Sutra, the Diamond Cutter Sutra, or the Fire Sutra, etc., etc. In the Vajrayana period, the scriptures are named with names like Guhya Samaja Tantra, He Vajra Tantra, Chakra Sangvara Tantra, Kala Chakra Tantra. Just means scripture, but a different word was used. What does tantra mean? Tan is a Sanskrit root to stretch, exactly cognate to the Latin word tenere, and even the English word thin, meaning stretched out, tenuous. Okay. Tra is usually an instrumental suffix. It means a device. It's exactly cognate to the Greek word tron, as in klystron, cyclotron. So a tantram, or tantra, is a stretching device, in other words, a loom. And then by extension, that which is woven on the loom, which is the text, or the fabric. And then by further extension, an organized body of teaching is tantra. That's all that the word tantra means historically. Just means a text or teaching. Then why does it have a sexual connotation? And why are there so many seminars on tantric sex? Well, because for both Hindus and Buddhists, by the time Vajrayana was developing in Buddhism, related events were also developing in Hinduism, and the two cross-fertilized each other. And in both cases, the scriptures were referred to as tantra. By that late period, sexual symbolism, and a little bit later on, actual sexual practice was incorporated. But it doesn't mean that tantra means sexual. It just means that that is one facet that is present within both the Hindu and the Buddhist tantric traditions. One facet. And it is present either at the symbolic level of iconography, where sexual union is portrayed, or at the real level of actually doing stuff that is harnessing the sexual energies. But that's not all that they did. By no means is that all. To somehow make Tantra equivalent to spiritual sex is historically extremely inaccurate. Vajrayana Buddhism is also called Tantric Buddhism because its texts are tantras. Where does the sex thing come in? What is most characteristic of Vajrayana Buddhism is that it makes use of upaya, skillful means. It takes whatever phenomena may come up and figures out a way to harness that towards the enlightenment experience. Specifically, it deals with a lot of phenomena that arise within the intermediate zone between surface consciousness and the source of consciousness. And it's got extremely elaborate techniques, physiological techniques, visualization techniques, you name it. Dozens and dozens and dozens of approaches to working with different kind of phenomena, but all harnessed towards the goal of taking you to the source, the spiritual source, which is formless, the Dharmakaya, the activity of impermanence, or in other words, emptiness. So it is difficult to characterize Vajrayana Buddhism simply. It's got so many complex approaches. Despite that, I will attempt to characterize it simply for you. Before doing that, though, I'll just mention that sexual experience is a very powerful opportunity for spiritual transcendence. So, not surprisingly, they harness the energy of sexual experience. But in what way is sexual experience a powerful opportunity for spiritual growth? Well, when one has sexual experience, one has strong, pleasant sensations. If one is able to maintain mindfulness and equanimity through those strong, pleasant sensations, one will, of course, gain profound insight and purification. Suffering equals pain multiplied by resistance. Spiritual purification equals pain multiplied by equanimity. Frustration equals pleasure multiplied by grasping. Spiritual purification equals pleasure multiplied by equanimity. So you can follow a path of pleasure. Big pleasure with a little bit of equanimity will purify. Little pleasure with a lot of equanimity, a lot of detachment, will purify. But big pleasure with big detachment will purify big. That's the theory. The difficulty is real easy to fool yourself with this one. Much easier to fool yourself with the path of pleasure than with the path of pain. That's why most people have their initial experiences of insight dealing with different kinds of aches and pains. The lessons are a little bit clearer. However, it is absolutely true that you can gain exactly the same insight and purification and never work with a single pain in your life, but only deal with pleasure, any kind of pleasure, including sexual pleasure. I mentioned that sitting has various meanings, one of which is as a barometer to check out where you're at. If you want to follow the path of pleasure only to enlightenment, if you want to follow the path of ecstasy, be it meditation ecstasy, music ecstasy, sexual ecstasy, substance ecstasy, that has a lot of problems associated with it, but if you want to follow the path of ecstasy, that's fine. There is such a path. However, how are you going to objectively check your progress? By having more ecstasy? No, that's not the place where you can objectively check your progress. Because you might be fooling yourself. How will you know? If you're practicing a sexual path or a pleasure path, let's more broadly say that, the way to check if insight and purification is arising as a result of your relationship to pleasure is to check what changes are taking place in your relationship to pain. That is the quick and dirty way to do it. So if you claim that you're able to have full orgasmic convulsive pleasure, and that's a samadhi, and that is a spiritual experience for you, may well be. So the way to check it out, how do you relate to convulsive levels of physical pain? Still in samadhi? Still a spiritual experience? Still connected to the source? Just as happy that way as you were with the orgasm? If the answer is not yes, well then, you got some more work to do. Every once in a while, check it out. See where you're at. You don't have to do anything hard as a practice, in theory. But unless you're willing to check it out, unless you're willing to see has your relationship to pain changed because of your work with pleasure, then you run a very real risk of fooling yourself. Of course, the converse is also true. You could be exposing yourself to all kinds of austerities and difficulties, sitting through all sorts of pain and hot and cold and exposing yourself to ordeals of different sorts. The way to check out whether that's working or not is to see, is your relationship to pleasure changing? Is pleasure bringing deeper satisfaction because of the work that you've done with the pain? If not, something's wrong. You're not really fundamentally purifying consciousness. The old asceticisms of the West, the hair shirt and self-flagellation, imply a taking on of pain out of a sense of being worthless. You're flagellating yourself because you think you're worthless. You're wearing a hair shirt, you're putting yourself down. That kind of taking on of pain, with that attitude, is probably not going to purify consciousness. Those people should be looking at how their relationship to pleasure is changing. Do they appreciate life more? If not, then there's some problem. I just want to say this apropos of this whole issue of the word tantric, because it is a historical term. And yes, indeed, some sexuality plays a role in these practices. But there are many, many, many other practices that involve other aspects of experience, clear light, the dream state, blissful energies flowing in the body, kundalini energy, out-of-the-body experiences, subtle sounds, the whole range of yogic-type phenomena, that's all incorporated into Vajrayana. If I had to give you a gross oversimplification of what Vajrayana is about, it would be that the form of practice from the outside appears to be a kind of invocation ritual, what Hindus would call a puja. You are making offerings to a deity that you're inviting, some archetypical figure, a god, a Buddha, a guardian, a demon, an angel, a witch, some sort of archetypical figure is being evoked, offerings are being made. That's the external form of the typical Vajrayana practice, the ceremony, the ritual that they do. However, incorporated in that ritual is a sequence of extremely powerful meditations.